The membership price is $10 for students, $20 for single persons, and $30 for a family. And the it will be possible to negotiate a membership out in the lobby after the lecture. Also this evening, the lobby will be, there will be a reception which is sponsored by the Faculty of Arts, in which coffee and other nourishment will be available, and you're all welcome to be there and urged to be there to meet the speaker if you wish, but to spend a pleasant time talking to the people here. There will be no lecture next weekend, Easter, it being Thanksgiving weekend, but on the 18th there will be lecture, and the schedule will resume on a weekly basis after that. The lecture on that occasion, on October the 18th, will be given by Professor John Aiken of the Department of English, Indiana University, Bloomington, Indiana. And the subject matter is, what are we reading when we read biography? Now, some may think you can answer that question simply by saying, well, it depends whose autobiography it is. I'm sorry, it's autobiography, not biography. But there will, I'm sure, be very much more to that lecture than that simplistic observation. So it is my great pleasure now to introduce to you this evening's speaker, who is Professor Errol Durbach of the Professor of Theater and English at this university, who will speak to the subject, the theater experience, or why do we enjoy watching real people counterfeiting fictional people. Professor Durbach is a native of South Africa. He has taught drama and theater history at UBC for some 35 years in the departments of theater, English, comparative literature, Central, Eastern, and Northern European Studies, and the drama program. He has a number of publications to his credit, including several books on Ibsen and many articles on modern drama, from Beckett to the South African playwright Athol Fugard. His history as a performer includes having acted in various productions in the Frederick Wood and the Tellus Theaters, especially as Karl Marx in Eleanor Marx, Ham in Endgame, and the Button Molder in Peer Gynt. He also has written a number of plays and adaptations which have been staged in the university theaters, including Dombey and Son, based on Dickens' novel, The Falstaff Project, based on Shakespeare's Henry plays, and Ibsen's Peer Gynt, which was cited as one of the best productions in Vancouver in 1999. And scenes of that were presented at the International Peer Gynt Festival in Norway in the subsequent year. I will now ask Professor Durbach to come forward, and I will turn you over for, I'm sure, what will be a very pleasant.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bill. It's a great privilege and an honor to be invited to introduce, to address the Vancouver Institute. I'm happy to be reminded of the topic of my talk. I'm slightly disconcerted to hear that the word enjoy actually appears within it, because reviewing my notes, you may not believe, by the time I come to the end of it, that enjoyment has anything to do with theater. And that's partly a consequence, I'm afraid, of the Vancouver Institute, which promotes a tone of very high seriousness. I do not want to overlook the entertainment factor in theater, and so I declare right at the beginning of the talk the one element that I seem to have omitted. I do assure you I take great pleasure in theater. I find it very entertaining. And if you don't believe me, let me recount a little anecdote. I was in New York this summer at the 10th International Ibsen Festival. I am the president of the International Ibsen Society, which sounds very grandiose, but it does impose certain duties upon one. We had only one free evening that week to go to the theater, and everybody was going to see Ibsen's Peer Gynt. Everybody was going to see Ibsen's Little Eyolf, which is a late masterpiece, full of awe and dread, awful and dreadful, but not quite in that sense. And I felt sort of constrained to go to see it, and then discovered that Bernadette Peters was in a production of Gypsy, and I thought I would go to see Bernadette Peters and Gypsy. And I didn't feel very guilty about it, but I sort of snuck out of the theater at the end, and whom should I bump into but the head dramaturge of the Norwegian National Theater, who was also sort of slinking out guilty-like. And we looked at each other, the head dramaturge and the president of the International Ibsen Society, and we had a sort of little giggle in the corridor. And I hope you will believe me when I say that entertainment, you know, is a very important element in theater. I want to talk this evening about the theater experience, and I want to sort of preface it again by saying this is very personal. It might not coincide with your sense of the theater, but I will indicate to you why the theater is very important to me, why it's a great privilege again for me to be able to write for it, and what I do when I write for the theater. Let me make some generalizations about theater and the theater experience. My first point really is that the theater itself, as a kind of physical place, as a geographical location, is really a cosmic space. In other words, we go to the theater, and it is for us, I believe, the largest possible dimension in which we recognize our own humanity. The shape of the theater has nearly always corresponded to our sense of the cosmos. I mean, you have to think your way back into the Greek theater to see the way in which this truism works. A round space, an almost round space, in which the gods, into which the gods descend as these huge cosmic forces that impinge upon our existence. And we watch our destinies, as it were, enacted by the protagonists of these plays. It's a fundamental assumption to me that when I go to the theater, I'm going to see a macrocosmic image of the human condition. I choose my examples really from plays that I've most recently taught because they're fresh in the mind and because I am admittedly lazy. I'm teaching Waiting for Godot at the moment, the Beckett play. The curtain goes up, if there's a curtain in the modern theater, on this play, and it is a devastation. There's nothing there except a dead tree, a mound, and a road. It's immediately apparent, it seems to me, that you know where you are in Waiting for Godot. And again, it seems to me to provide the largest possible image of the human experience in the mid-1950s and probably now. Of course, there are Christian icons contained within some of those elements. But if you come to Waiting for Godot, what you see is a blasted universe. You see, I guess in T.S. Eliot's words, a wasteland. You see nothing there. You see a post-cultural, post-Holocaust world in which you wait with a certain element of dread. So the human being in the world, it seems to me, is what we are looking at when we see the actor in the scenography. What we are observing is our representative, as it were, in the larger macrocosmic context. And in case we miss the point in Waiting for Godot, it is impressed upon us by Vladimir, by one of the characters in the play, who in the second act makes the point, just in case we have missed it. But at this place, he says, at this moment of time, all mankind is us, whether we like it or not. And I think, you know, there's this quality about the play, which indeed is very often subliminal. It may not be hammered home to us in the theater that what we're looking at is our representative on the stage. Sometimes, in fact, the actor is very conscious, and the playwright is very conscious about pointing this out to the audience. Shakespeare called his theater the globe. Again, this universal sense of a macrocosmic space in which the thing happens. Hamlet talks about the world, and he talks about the world as if it were the theater, as if it were the stage. And he makes direct reference to the elements of the Elizabethan theater, impressing upon us that he is the human being in the world, in the cosmos. This goodly frame, he says, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. Promontory is a stage, a thrust stage that shoots out into the audience. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire. And remember that over the Elizabethan stage there hangs exactly such a canopy. If you go to the replication of the Globe Theatre in London, it's there. You look up and what do you see? Exactly that, the painted cloth, the canopy, with fretted with golden fire. I think when we go to the modern theatre, this sense of a cosmic space seems to disappear. We find ourselves very often in a modern living room. And one says to oneself, what is a modern living room to do, you know, with the Greek theatre or the Shakespearean theatre or the medieval theatre or the world? So I sort of segue into the other play that I've just taught, which takes place in a bourgeois living room, which is Ibsen's terrible and awful play, Ghosts. A very dark play, very dark indeed, literally so, because it rains throughout much of the play, and the action itself is very dark. The boy has come home to die. He is afflicted with a venereal disease. The mother has to understand what is happening to the boy, and it is very, very difficult for her to do this. Ultimately, in the final moments of the play, she cannot deny what is happening because the boy seems to have been possessed by some kind of seizure at the end. I'm not very good on the pathology of the play, but it seems to be a form of cerebral paresis, and he seems to be trapped in it, and he seems at that moment to be dying. An amazing thing happens in the middle-class parlor just at that moment when the boy is dying. All of a sudden, the sun comes up. Ibsen has this extraordinary stage direction. The sun rises, he says. It's an amazing moment in the play, which up to this point has been so incredibly dark. The sun comes out, and the stage is flooded with light. It is suffused with light. It is full, as it were, of extraordinary heat and warmth. In many ways, the sun is emblematic, as light always is in the theater, of warmth and comfort and satisfaction. And I guess it's the very thing for which the boy has been hoping, that is, an infusion of joy into his life. The sun is surely more than that. It is the moment of, as clearly as you possibly can, in the brightest possible light. This is the inescapable moment. The sun is also knowledge. And I think, you know, one has to remember that that Oedipus, in his trauma, cries out to the chorus, "It is Apollo, friends, it is Apollo who has done this to me." And Apollo is, of course, the god of light, but also the god of knowledge and insight and an absolute kind of inescapable truth. So when the sun comes up, I have the sense always in that terrible play of the inescapable nature of the truth, which for one's entire life one has refused to face. The equally terrible thing about the ending is that when the sun comes up, it illuminates the landscape. And for the first time in the play, we see what lies beyond the French windows. And we see glaciers and ice peaks and permafrost and snow. And the heat of the sun and the extraordinary coldness of the landscape seem somehow to to speak to each other in a kind of contradiction. It is a horrible image of an indifferent natural universe. But that is the consequence, Ibsen seems to be saying, through the technology of this play. It is the awful consequence of facing reality. When you face reality, you are confronted very often with a kind of total desolation. It's a huge statement, it seems to me, and it seems to me that even a play of modern bourgeois life can open up these enormous perspectives and show us this spectacle of grief on the one hand and inescapable tragic reality on the other. And then I have to point out to you, because this is really the point I'm making, that the effect that the end of Ghosts has upon us is created by a totally artificial means. It is, in fact, created by the lighting designer and the lighting technician and a skillful scenic artist. It is just a picture. It is just a ray of light created artificially by a lamp. And we contemplate what I take to be the first, maybe the major paradox of theater. That we witness truth, we witness a kind of inescapable reality, and it is mediated to us through the technique of illusion and artifice. We are asked to accept truth through the medium of illusion. And this, it seems to me, is one of the great conundrums of theater that one needs to address and one needs to try to come to terms with. And I guess one of the first people who tried to come to terms with this and give it a kind of theoretical basis was Coleridge. And he has this wonderful, beautiful, marvelous little phrase that sort of explains to us why we can sit in a theater and allow a lighting technician and a scene painter, how we can allow them, you know, as it were, to appropriate our sensibilities and our perception to the point where we accept this as real. Coleridge has a theory, and it's called a suspension of disbelief. It's not that we actually believe that we are looking at reality, it's that we choose not to disbelieve. And that's about as much, I guess, as the theatre artist can hope for, that the audience will choose not to disbelieve. And I think the theatre trains us very, very quickly in this approach to theatre, in this willingness, as it were, to accept the artificial for the real. We agree to accept certain conventions. We enter into a kind of tacit agreement with the performers that for the 2-hour or the 3-hour traffic of the play, we will pretend that what we're looking at is in fact an image of reality. We accept the fictional as the real. And I love the theory. I mean, what would we do without Coleridgean suspenders, I wonder? I also like smashing the theory to bits. And I guess this is one of the qualities that you might find in this talk tonight, that I will contradict virtually everything I say. Because the theater experience really cannot be boiled down to a single response. If it's this, it's also that. I think it's when the theater breaks the convention, when the theater says, I am not really asking you to suspend disbelief. I'm actually asking you to smash it. That the theater for me becomes really interesting, that it engages us perhaps more vitally than this tacit agreement to not to disbelieve. We approach even closer to the notion of the real, it seems to me, when the suspension of disbelief is shattered, and where we are forced in the theater to confront the artificial. I offer a quotation from my paraphrase of Peer Gynt. I think Peer Gynt is one of those plays that really looks crucially at this element in the drama. And I don't claim here to be reproducing Ibsen word for word, but this is basically his idea, which I've tried to represent in his verse form. It occurs when, right at the end of the play, when Pierre has come back to Norway after 60 years of traveling around and messing his life, and he comes back into the community that he had once fled, and he discovers that everybody thinks he's dead and that he's passed sort of into a kind of national mythology. And he claims not to be dead. He claims to be real, but nobody will listen to him. And he tries to reason with the villagers, and he says this. A slaughtered pig is heard to squeal. So, do you ask, is that noise real? And if it's killed within a play, does that same shriek not cause dismay? Is there no bridge from life to art? Peer Gynt dies. Oh, just a part, just theater. Counterfeited grief. Try suspending disbelief. So he goes the Coleridgean route. And then the button molder says to Pierre, and the button molder is nearly always determined, you know, to shatter whatever hope Pierre might have. And the button molder says to Pierre, don't blame them, Pierre. It's theatre's curse. Real men don't speak in rhyming verse. The play will end, and Pierre will fade. A dreamer's dream, a shadow's shade. The actor's all that will remain, but he's not you. He mimics pain. Big setback for Pierre. See, disbelief is shattered. And Pierre responds to the button molder. Devil, I will not despair. I am the substantial peer. They've been watching me all night. I exist within their sight. They are proof of my existence. It's ontological persistence. There's an even better example than this. I take this again. It's another quote. It's from my very favorite of all plays, which is Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. Another play that, although you might not realize it, begins to push at the boundaries of tragic art and smashes disbelief in order, as it were, to create something other, which it's very hard actually to name. This is right at the end of the play. Antony's dead. She is a prisoner of Octavius Caesar, and she knows what's going to happen to her. She's going to be dragged through the streets of Rome, which is bad enough. But the worst thing that enters her mind as her, I guess, subsequent fate is that people will make plays about her, and that the Roman actors will act the tragedy of Antony and Cleopatra. And this shocks her and horrifies her more, maybe, than being dragged as a political prisoner through the streets of Rome. And this is what she says. Antony shall be brought drunken forth. Present him as an alcoholic drunk. Antony shall be brought drunken forth. And I shall see some squeaking Cleopatra. Boy, my greatness in the posture of a whore. Our love affair will be travestied. But of course she says more than that. And you notice already that this is a play talking about a play of Antony and Cleopatra. The interesting word in that little speech of hers is the verb, which is boy. She uses the word boy as a verb because, as you probably realize by now, the role of Cleopatra in Antony and Cleopatra in Shakespeare's theater in the 17th century would have been played by a young boy. So what do you have? You have a character in a play talking about her part performed inadequately by a boy who is squeaking her role, which means that this is not quite the real Cleopatra. I hope I make myself sufficiently unclear. A little later in the same play, she's indeed arrested by Octavius Caesar, and she's put in the custody of a rather stolid Roman soldier, a rather nice man, but of limited imaginative capacity. And she's the only one he can talk to, and so she talks to him about Antony. And she describes her dead lover. His face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon, which kept their course and lighted this little O, the earth. His legs bestrid the ocean. His reared arm crested the world. Realms and islands were as plates dropped from his pocket. And she says to the Roman soldier, "Think you there was or might be such a man as this I dreamt of?" And because he's very honest, he says, "Gentle madam, no." And she replies, "You lie up to the hearing of the gods." Interestingly, she accuses him of lying. "But if there be," she goes on to say, "if there be, or ever were one such, it's past the size of dreaming." There's an element of doubt even in her own image of Antony. It's conditional. She uses the subjunctive, "if there be or ever were one such." It's past the size of dreaming, and I guess the size of dreaming is really what I'm talking about. I hope I make myself sufficiently unclear. I guess what I'm trying to say, if I can indeed clarify this conundrum contained within the play itself, what I'm suggesting is that theatre provides a sense of absolute reality. It's what the philosophers call ontological reality, an absolute source of reality, beyond the action that the play itself contains. It gestures towards it. It reminds you that dreaming has a size. You move beyond the solid world of scene painting and the artifice of the lighting designer. You move beyond this, you move beyond artifice, you move beyond illusion into another dimension of experience. I really like Virginia Woolf's discussion on Ibsen. Virginia Woolf hated realism, but she looked at Ibsen's plays and she was prepared to concede that this is a kind of realism that she can really buy. And she has a really interesting comment about Ibsen's realism. His plays, she says, are full of things. They're full of lamps and books and waste paper baskets. She calls this all the paraphernalia of reality. I mean, all these heavy things, these objects that lie around. And then she makes this rather remarkable and amazing statement. She says, "These things, the paraphernalia of reality, have at certain times," she says, "to become the veil through which we see infinity." It's a wonderful phrase. We don't see infinity with great clarity. We see it, as it were, through gauze. We see it, as it were, through a veil. But we detect, beyond and through the solidity of the real object, an image, she says, of infinity. that which has no end, that which is not curtailed by time. I'm not quite sure of the nature of infinity to which he refers. I think it is the infinite resources of the human psyche itself. She sees Ibsen's theater as a locus of ultimate truth. She's not the only one to do this, of course. People have looked at theatre as a source of ultimate truth for centuries. Theatre is the kind of corroborative evidence, in other words, to which even philosophy will from time to time appeal for some kind of ratification. And I'm thinking here particularly of Hegel, the great 19th century German philosopher, and his use of Sophocles' Antigone. A constant reference to Sophocles' Antigone spread through all his philosophical works. He goes back to theatre because he sees in Sophocles' Antigone a debate. He sees a dialectical structure, the opposition of two unreconcilable truths in conflict. He sees truth as counterpositive, to use Mavor Moore's term for this phenomenon in the theatre. Two truths of equal validity, but essentially contradicting each other. And they come into collision, he says. They come into dramatic conflict. And out of the dramatic conflict of these elements in collision, he reconstructs the function of the human mind. The human mind, he says, is theatrical, essentially. It deals with conflict as Sophocles does in the Antigone. It is the model, it is the paradigm of the way in which civilization shapes itself and moves forward. Proof? No proof. Only a reference to Sophocles' Antigone for a kind of absolute corroboration of an idea. Theater, in other words, is a primary text. It is a form of absolute truth, also for the intuitive theories of the psychiatrist. If Hegel uses Sophocles' Antigone, Freud, of course, uses Sophocles' Oedipus. He also uses Ibsen's Rebecca West in Rosmersholm to come to certain conclusions. And they are, for him, proof positive. I guess what I'm trying to get at, is that theatre, in its embodiment of the size of dreaming, if you like, represents intellectual and spiritual authority for what is, after all, an abstract and unprovable theory. Just go back to theatre as a source of ultimate truth for the idea. And I do this frequently myself, much to the amusement of my family. My analogies are always drawn from theatre, and at best they think this is a kind of harmless eccentricity. At worst, they think I'm divorcing myself from the realities of actual life and taking refuge, you know, in some kind of fiction. I'm saying I'm really not turning away from life at all. I'm penetrating it in the only way I really know how. So please don't dismiss my foolish behavior, you know, in constantly referring to elements in theater as a kind of intuitive proof of something that I'm trying to articulate. People often use the phrase theater of the absurd in order to indicate a nonsensical situation. I cannot think of a theater form that so deeply penetrates the nature of truth than the theater of the absurd. So that's my big point about ontological reality, about theater and reality. And I want to move on to something maybe slightly less abstruse. My next point about theater is a rather obvious one, and that is that theater is really a collective experience. We experience theatre as a society. We experience theatre as a community, as a group of people. And we're all there in the same place at the same time, observing the same action. And sometimes the action we observe is hard action and difficult action, and sometimes very painful, almost unendurable action. And I think of Dr. Samuel Johnson editing Shakespeare's plays in isolation and having to read them outside of the context of the theater experience, having to read them in the privacy of his study, and coming finally to the end scene in King Lear, where Cordelia is dead and Lear comes on howling, and he can't endure it. He can't deal with it. He cannot go back to it. He cannot re-edit it. He cannot visit it again. The experience of reading the play is for him too stark, it's too immediate, and far too painful to endure. That's because he's reading it, it seems to me, in the privacy of his study or wherever he did his editorial work. But I think if we go to see King Lear and this thing happens at the end of the play, and it happens so traumatically, and Lear howls at us in such agony, it is the fact that we are a community, that we endure the spectacle as a group, that somehow makes it possible for us to witness it without hysteria. It seems to me that the presence of other people in the theater are also a consoling presence in the face of uttermost tragedy. We depend upon other people, as it were, in the community to support us through this. And I believe that happens, even if the people sitting next to us or behind us are total strangers. It is a community response to a dreadful event where we all recognize the fact that we share a common set of values, and we see value of that kind being obliterated under our noses. And it has this immediate impact, and we all share it. We laugh together. I'm not talking about comedy. But we also cry together in the theater. And I think the fact that we do this together as a community is an aspect of the whole theater experience. It is communal. It is a shared experience. And now let me immediately contradict myself, since I said I would deny almost everything I say, which I'm now going to do. I've just been suggesting that theater unites us in one, what Yeats calls, one lofty emotion, and that, I think, is true. But it's equally true to say that theater divides us. And that part of the function of theater is very often not to hold us, in communal thrall to a spectacle that we are seeing. Theater is also intended to raise points of debate. It is also, as I say to my students, and they find this very amusing because I keep using the word over and over again, it is dialectical. Some of my students are here this evening, and I'm sure they will forgive me. I've tried not to use the word this year. By dialectical, I mean an argument, rather like Mavor Moore's counterpositives, rather like Hegel's sense, of opposites in collision, a dialectical theater that essentially leaves the issues wide open, doesn't resolve them, leaves us to grapple with the with what George Steiner calls the great undecidables. And sometimes it is impossible, in fact, to decide. And theater says, some of you will think this and some of you will think that. And you may think in very different terms about the same set of situations, which is why we have to come back to the theater every time a great and undecidable play addresses the great conundrum of existence once again in subsequent performance. We see the same play again and again and again. But of course, you never see the same play again and again and again. And that is the nature of theater. You never see the same play twice. You see the play, but it is inevitably different. The emphases are different, even if slightly different. And it's possible to see the same performance of a play in a run and see it differently each time. I must say I have a predilection for this kind of theater, for the kind of theater that generates difference, that sets truths in opposition. So it becomes very, very difficult for us sitting in the theater to say we all share this idea, we all share this response. I think sometimes, as audience, sometimes as critics of theatre, we have to acknowledge this principle of, and I quote Steiner again, he calls it meaningful undecidability. It's not a matter of saying, I don't know what this play is all about. It's a matter of saying, this play is about this, but it's also about that. And both are equally meaningful, but I cannot decide on the truth that emerges, as it were, from the conflict. Antigone is such a play for George Steiner. The point that I'm trying to make is that we have to keep shifting the theories that we inherit. One is Coleridge's theory. This theory about social cohesiveness is an Aristotelian theory. Aristotle says, in his great work on the Poetics, that we go to the play and it has certain restorative and healing qualities. We go to the play and it purges us, in a sense, he says, of our own human imperfections by watching the spectacle. He calls the process catharsis. We come out of the theater refreshed and healed. Well, we don't always. We sometimes leave the theater, and again, I must say, I have a kind of predilection for this kind of theater. We leave it not consoled and healed, not reassured, but quite deliberately off balance, quite desperately off balance, as a matter of fact. And therefore, what we have to do is to seek for a form of equilibrium in our terrible uncertainty. So it forces us, in a sense, to reconsider what we have seen, to try another point of view, to try to extend ourselves, to see both parts of the query, to discover maybe some kind of new perspective in other productions of Antigone, or in other productions of Hedda Gabler, which is the play, I guess, that I find more decidable than my wife, and about which we argue every time we see it. And I think this is good, you know. I think an audience should argue. They should argue. They should go out, not reassured and comforted, but they should go out into a coffee shop and argue, because the play does not provide simple solutions to the issues that it raises. And that, of course, you know, one may be able to come after several cups of coffee to some kind of conclusion about Hedda Gabler, but I have the sense, you know, that every new context creates its own set of undecidables. And so that's the kind of theatre I like. I find that kind of theatre very often in Shakespeare. I certainly find it in Ibsen. I find it in Beckett. I'm going on too long, but I do want to finish this because I have another point or two. I wouldn't talk about the theatre experience. At least I shouldn't. I should talk about theatre experiences, because there is no one single form of theatre. And I guess the kind of theatre that I've been talking about in speaking about ontological reality and so on is really Pirandello's theatre. It's really the theatre of philosophical ideas. This is why this tone of high seriousness seems to have taken over so completely. A kind of theatre in which the audience is invited to think about the nature of reality and therefore its own reality, the reality of self, the reality of identity. There are other forms of theatre. Let me touch on them very briefly. There's the theatre of Bertolt Brecht, for instance. Brecht sees theatre as a very, very persuasive instrument of social transformation. He believes we go to the theatre, and through the theatre experience, we are shown how to change the circumstances in which we live. In other words, it's a theatre of change, a theatre of political change. And so we come to the theatre in order, as it were, to have our angle of vision changed by what we see. The audience must now think about the political means of remedying the world. And that, for Brecht, is what theatre is all about. And yes, I think probably for some people it is, and for some it isn't. But I like the Brechtian theory, and I like what he does in confronting the audience. He has a general dictum that one has to close the play, but one has to leave the issue open. It's all contained in a little prologue that he writes to one of his plays called The Good Woman of Szechuan. Play ends, and an actor steps up to the footlights, and he speaks to the audience, speaks directly to us. And he says to us, "So what would you suggest? You've seen what's happened on the stage. Suddenly the play ends, and we haven't written a conclusion. You better go and do it. What would you suggest? So what's your answer? Nothing's been arranged." And he asks four pertinent questions of the audience. Better pay attention. Should men be better? It's a matter of human nature. Should the world be changed as a consequence of social institutions? Or just the gods, panoply that controls what happens? Or ought there to be none? So we, for our part, feel well and truly done. We're finished. You've seen the play. That's all we have to do. We can't solve the dilemma for you. You have to go and do it yourself. There's one solution that we know, that you should now consider as you go, what sort of measures you would recommend to help good people to a happy end. Ladies and gentlemen, in you we trust. There must be happy endings. Must. 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 Or, you know, there's the theatre of Antonin Artaud, theatre of cruelty, which for those people who like this form of theatre experience is a therapeutic means of healing the damaged spirit of the super sophisticated civilization in which we live. It's a theatre of spiritual recovery, in which the audience must participate in a ritual of purification. So maybe that is another aspect of the theatre experience. Whatever kind of theatre experience you prefer, I think one point remains vital, that theatre is a collaborative art. I would say that when we go to the theatre, we place ourselves in a particular position by placing the bum in the seat and by buying the ticket. In other words, by exposing ourselves to performance. Theatre is an act, if you like, of tacit ritual in which we participate. And the stage and the auditorium really share in this profound human experience. We are never, it seems to me, in the theatre, mere passive observers in a situation that leaves us totally indifferent. We are feeling beings, we are thinking beings, who recognize the actor as a kind of surrogate self, and we acquiesce in a truth which, thankfully, circumstances spares us from acting out ourselves. This is not like cinema. It's not like television. We share real time and real space with living beings, both in the audience and on stage. And we do whatever it is that the performers want us to do for them. They teach us the conventions. And as you know, Shakespeare points out in the prologue to Henry V, we piece out whatever imperfections they might have with our thoughts. When they speak of horses, we see them printing their proud hooves in the receding earth. When they speak of cows, we hear them mooing and we smell them splatting all over the field, as they do, I think, most memorably in Stones in His Pockets, which is now playing at the Playhouse, where in the final moments of the play, we are immersed in what I have to call cowness. But it all exists in our own imaginations. And we let it happen. We participate in that. Let me try and sum it up. Theatre for me is a collaborative art in which we complete the action by imagining or dreaming or envisioning our own conclusion to the action. Or, alternatively, by developing our own vital scenarios of personal introspection in relation to the action, and maybe opening ourselves up to existential change in what has been a play, essentially about ourselves. So I want to quote one last time from my version, my adaptation of Peer Gynt. This is sort of how I bring my play to an end,
which is, as you will see, a kind of magpie attempt to pull Pirandello and Brecht and maybe a little bit of Artaud into fusion. So the play ends, and the two actors playing Peer Gynt, I have two Peers, an old Peer and a young Peer, come right up to the audience again, as they do in The Good Women of Szechuan, and address the audience in person. Dear audience, this dream has ended. Can human frailty be amended? Are we judged by choice or by intention? Can we be changed through intervention? Young Peer. Is self an essence or an action? Is it substance or abstraction? What I dream or what I do? Who am I? And who are you? Thank you. Thank you.
Professor Durback is willing to take some questions. Have we any? Going once? Going twice?
Were there boy actors? I believe there were. Yes. I believe there were. Yes, boy actors. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yes. In this sense, you're absolutely right. But what I'm thinking is that when you go to the cinema, I mean, the image is there, you know, and there's no possibility of the audience interacting with that. There's always the possibility of the audience interacting with the actors on the stage. And performance is nearly always response, in a way. The theatre is responsive. And you know immediately if you're an actor on the stage whether you have a responsive audience, and that affects the performance. Now, it cannot happen in the movie. The movie's fixed, as it were. It is the celluloid image, and it is the same every time. Performance is never the same every time. It always shifts and changes, and usually in response to what the audience is doing in the theater, whether it's coughing or laughing or crying. It's always responsive in one way or another. And so I would think that's a major difference. The better analogy maybe is with the symphony orchestra or the recital. Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, the question is how did Brecht maintain the artistic integrity of his plays without allowing them to sort of topple over into propaganda? It's a really interesting question. I remember once encountering a Brecht play, and being totally bewildered by the action, and going to do a little dramaturgical research to find out how he handled a particular scene, and discovered his Modellbuch, in other words, his director's notes for the scene. And I was really, in a way, quite annoyed, because the director's notes for the scene revealed what it was all about, and clearly it was didactic. And in his direction of it, it could only move in one way. In other words, in the direction of propaganda. But interestingly enough, the stage directions and what he wished to see happen was not embodied in the text. And so I went to my colleague who taught Brecht in the theater department, and I said, "Oh, this is funny, isn't it? It seems so important that, that the thing be played like this, and yet he doesn't say so in the printed version of the play." And he said to me, "Well, of course he doesn't say that in the printed version of the play. That would make his play propaganda." And he's saying to every subsequent director, "Here it is. How are you going to handle it? Do it freely." And I think that is probably true about Brecht. He pushes you to the edge. He asks the questions at the end of The Good Woman of Szechuan, and they are, in a sense, loaded questions. One has to say, you know, should men be better? No, men are pretty good creatures. Should the world be changed? Yes, of course the world should be changed. How? I assume through revolution. But he doesn't actually say that. He just pushes you to the edge where the only possible conclusion may be that you can come to is that the world has to shift from a capitalist to a communist economy. But he doesn't say it. He places you in the position of arriving at that conclusion yourself. Now, we're no longer inclined to arrive at that conclusion, it seems to me. So what does one do with The Good Woman of Szechuan now that communism has revealed its failure so spectacularly in the world? You do something slightly different. And so I'm interested to see what Langara, for instance, might be doing with the Caucasian Chalk Circle. But you do that play again because it's not propaganda. It may lead you towards a kind of simplistic response to a predicament. Doesn't actually push you into it. And so he's discreet. Sorry, would I call Ibsen a propagandist to the same extent? I think, you know, Ibsen is essentially dialectical. He opens the thing up to contradictory views and opinions and ideas. And very hard, really, to work one's way through Ibsen and see the authorial voice directing you towards a particular conclusion. It doesn't happen. The result is that, you can read Rosmer's Holm and condemn them for what they do, Rosmer and Rebecca, or you can read it 2 years hence and sort of see them in a slightly different way. So there's no compulsion in Ibsen to interpret as he might wish you to do. And he himself defines his technique as an arm's length technique, you know, writing about ghosts. Does Mrs. Alving give her dying son the morphine at the end of the play, or doesn't she? Because the curtain comes down before anything happens. It just comes down with the mountains and the light. And so people write these furious letters to Ibsen saying, does she do it or doesn't she? And he says, I've no idea. You know, I don't know. It's not up to me, is it? He says. In no other play has the author been so totally extrinsic from the writing itself. And so that's the impression he gives, being totally extrinsic, not being didactic, not being propagandist, offering alternatives which you have to take out of the theater with you and in one way or another decide. That's my sense of it.
All right, up at the back.
Why is Antony and Cleopatra my favorite Shakespeare play? when I was about 28, Hamlet was my favorite play. I am now 62. and it is the tragedy of late middle age. I guess that's part of an answer, and it seems to be flippant. But I guess, you know, one ages with the plays, and the poignancy of that situation that Antony and Cleopatra find themselves in seems to me, you know, particularly apropos to the strained relations in the modern world, you know, to the fractured nature of human relations, and particularly sexual relations and married relations. And there's two people suffering a tremendous trauma in their own lives and trying, as it were, to deal with it by fabricating images that will somehow contain them or hold them together. And it just seems to me that there is no more relevant play to me, at any rate, than Antony Cleopatra at the moment. I hope that I may indeed not ever have to pass on to King Lear. Yes. 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 Yeah, Gerald is one of my masochistic students. He's taking my Beckett course, and we're looking at the plays of Beckett, some of which he writes for the theatre, some of which he writes for television, some of which he writes for radio, some of which he writes for, the cinema. And so you have a single writer writing for essentially four different performance media, and what you see is one medium actually bleeding into the next, so that some of the techniques of the stage play will bleed into the television play, which will then bleed back into the theatre play. And so there is a kind of interchange that happens in the modern theatre between the forms written for the different media. And as Gerald points out, if you've seen Tales of the Lost Formicans, which is a really quite remarkably good play, I think, it is about a group of anthropologists from, I don't know, Alpha Centauri, somewhere in deep space, who are making what seems to be a kind of video documentary of life on Earth. In other words, our lives. And it doesn't always work, and sometimes they have to splice it, and sometimes they have to run it backwards. And we look at life on Earth as if it were seen through the eyes of an alien group that doesn't quite understand us, but is doing its best to represent us worthily, although failing most spectacularly to do so. And so you certainly see one medium, as it were, bleeding into another in that play. And I think, on the whole, you're right. The arc that one could once trace so neatly in drama doesn't actually work any longer. But then it didn't work in Antony and Cleopatra, which has something like, 52 or 55 scenes or something. A very jagged play, a very jagged structure that leaps all over the known map of the world. And so, in a way, Shakespeare was anticipating the cinema, I like to think. And Ibsen was certainly anticipating the cinema in plays like John Gabriel Borkman, where the most amazing things happen in the realistic theatre that the realistic theatre cannot actually take account of unless it stages them cinematically. And that, you know, that sounds like a bit of a riddle, and I don't want to go into it, but that is true. I mean, ever since the 19th century and the invention of the camera, I think things began to change for the theatre too. And so, yes, theatre form, I believe, is indeed, you know, affected by... and so is acting, by the way. So is acting. Actors don't have to do much in front of a camera. In fact, they're not supposed to, hardly move their lips at all. And then they come and act on the stage and hardly move their lips at all. And that's that's really not any good. Yes, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Political references and so forth. Mm. I don't know whether that improves the enjoyment of the
experience. Oh dear. I mean, I'm guilty of that. If
if hear that question?
The question is very often the modern approach to Shakespeare, particularly in Canada, and I think that is right. Tends to make these plays contemporary, to bring them, as it were, out of the Elizabethan world into the modern world. And does this improve the play to do that? Well, that's what I chose to do with the Falstaff project. And the interesting thing was that as the Falstaff project was being staged, so there were a series of articles in the Canadian Theatre Review, CTR, Canadian Theatre Review, which spoke about, you know, Shakespeare in Canada. And everybody in Canada apparently does this sort of thing with Shakespeare. In a way, it was fortuitous. I suggested that when we did the Falstaff project, that we do it as both an Elizabethan and a modern play. In other words, that it should sort of fill two different time frames which then intersected. Now, it so happens, and I actually didn't intend this, it just happened to work this way. The Falstaff project is about, obviously, Falstaff, but it's also about the rule and the reign of Henry IV. Henry IV is not a nice man, and he has acquired the throne by very devious means, and he intends to pass it on to his son, who is also called Henry. And the son, also called Henry, is an even nastier piece of work, in my view, than the father. But you have, you know, you have a father and a son, both of them called Henry. And one of the reviewers said, "Ah, no play could be more modern or contemporary. What do we have in the United States? We have a father and a son, a pretty malignant father and an even more malignant son. And what is more, they are both called George. And wasn't he clever?" Well, you know, I really didn't intend to be. But it worked out like that. And I think, you know, people will see the analogy where it fits. And you don't have to push too far. And I thought we weren't pushing far at all. But that's the way it read. Which meant, you know, that the play became vitally contemporary, at least to this critic and to some people who saw it, than it might otherwise have been in Elizabethan dress. And I thought, wow, it's not a bad idea to have made Shakespeare our contemporary.
All right, one more question.
Well, Professor Durbeck has been very generous with
thoughtfulness
and length of his questions, and thank you very much.
It's my pleasure entirely.
Now call on Marjorie Fee, the Associate Dean of the Faculty of Art.
I'm here in place of Dean Nancy Galini, who very much regrets not being able to be here herself. I always say that, but in this case, she will regret it because I will tell her how lovely and interesting the lecture was. But also, I think my role as a stand-in has given me a bit of a sense of how this lecture operates. I am one of the means by which deans transcend time and space. Anyway, I'm the Associate Dean, and I'm an Associate Dean of Students, and we're not really selected for our eloquence. We're really selected for our sympathetic and hard-headed natures, kind of contradictory. So when I was asked if I would do this, I was very happy because I love to hear Errol Durbach speak, and we were Associate Deans together, but I also thought in a narcissistic way, well, he's going to sound so witty and so clever, and I'm going to sound so dull. So I thought, well, what will I do? And I thought, a few years ago, Irene Adele gave a talk at this very same place, and the associate dean of the time, who was delegated to come and thank him, was Errol. So then I thought, well, Ira can do it. And so he will.
This is called Sweet Revenge. Errol, you have done a wonderful job this evening illustrating, actually, I think it was Emerson, speaking of Whitman, who said, consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. And in terms of your representation of a statement and a contradiction, I think the word was dialectic, you did a wonderful job. I think this has been, in many ways, a very dangerous lecture, because it has left all of us open-minded, I hope, and unsure and uncertain about conclusions and about the endings of plays and perhaps even the endings of lectures, because here I am drifting into a lecture. Your comments about the willing suspension of disbelief are very pertinent, particularly for a playwright you didn't mention, and a playwright I've spent some time reading, Tom Stoppard, because at the performance of Real Inspector Hound, a play which is about two theater critics who are witnessing a play on stage, and then they become quite involved in the play. And in the second act, what happens is a phone is ringing, and one of the two critics just can't stand it. He can't stand that phone. Someone has to answer it. And he gets up out of his seat. Now, you're watching all this. And he answers the phone, and to his shock, it's for him. And he gets involved in a conversation, and then the actors come in, and he gets involved in the production. And this is a spoof on an Agatha Christie play. And the next thing that happens is this critic is shot right before our eyes and everyone's eyes. And in this particular production in the provinces, as they say, outside of London, a clergyman in the audience was so appalled that this critic was killed before his eyes, he leapt up out of his seat and he jumped onto the stage and began to perform last rites. This is a remarkable moment, it seems to me, in the willing suspension of disbelief. But in any case, I could stand here for a very long time and talk about Errol's accomplishments and his performances, in particular on stage, where as an actor he has been remarkably and always convincing. As a matter of fact, avoiding the pitfalls of, say, the 18th century actor Henry Thornton, who is described as a figure, and I quote, who could bustle through a part with considerable ease, though entirely unacquainted with the author's words. In fact, one night, while acting Biron in the tragedy of Isabella, Thornton died on stage without handing over the letter which unraveled the plot. Prostrate before the audience in the final scene, one of the other actors implored Mr. Thornton in these words, Thornton, the letter, the letter. Miraculously, Thornton rose up from the dead. He removed the letter from his pocket and said to the astonished crowd, one thing I had forgot, through a multiple of business, give this letter to my father. It will explain all. He then promptly re-embraced the arms of death. And I think at this moment you might want to recall George S. Kaufman's quip. It relates to Gertrude Lawrence in a production, a Broadway production of a play called Skylark. Kaufman said this, it was a bad play saved by a bad performance. But tonight, Errol, it's been a splendid performance. And indeed, we are very grateful for the way you've illuminated the theatrical landscape. And on behalf of the audience and the Institute, we indeed thank you. Please join me in congratulating your older brother.